Jack Spierka with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday. Beginning with the oldest of them and going forward, there's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years. So sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today, folks, we are flashing back to originally October the 13th, 2011. This episode was episode 762, and it was Tom Hale on serving in the Peace Corps. Basically, Peace Corps survival lessons. A couple interesting things about this show. One, the way this show even happened, it was, you know, shortly, I'm like about a year into doing interviews, I guess, because for those that are new to the show, the first year and a half of the show, there was almost no interviews because it was just me, because I was podcasting from my car every morning. And you can't really do interviews well like that anyway, on my way to work. And but by the time we did this episode, I was well established and had left my former life behind and was, you know, from a studio, and we had all the interviews going, and I had also really established and built up the member support brigade. And early on in that, I had people reach out to me and say, hey, do you do anything, you know, you're a veteran, do you do anything for military veterans? And I was like, you know, I could do a discount on the MSB, so I put in a service discount. And I made it open to military, law enforcement, and first responders, like paramedics and EMTs and things like that. And somebody had reached out and said, would you offer the service discount to members of the Peace Corps? And I actually served with some members of the Peace Corps, or I would say interacted with members of the Peace Corps. When I was on a deployment in Honduras, we were building roads in the middle of effing nowhere in a place called the Aguan River Valley. And I had a lot of respect for those guys because in a lot of ways, you know, they maybe had more freedom than we did, but we had a much better quality of life than they did. A couple times we allowed them into the camp, they joined us in our mess tent and all, and they're like, man, you guys have no idea. And I'm like, no, I've seen the conditions that people live in around here, and I know you basically live with them, so I do have an idea. And so, having experienced that, I had tremendous respect for the service that these guys do. I also knew something else. You don't join the Peace Corps and they send you to like Tokyo or Milan or Berlin or Sydney, right? You go to a third world shithole. In the case of our guest who came in for this interview, whose name was Tom Hale, or probably still is, I imagine, Tom Hale, he went to Madagascar. And not the part tourists go to. And so when I was asked that, I said yes. Well, a funny thing happened. It wasn't a large number of people. There were actually a significant number of people that had a problem with it. They were like, oh, anyway, this service discount, Peace Corps. I don't know what you think the Peace Corps does. But the service, it's 2-year service. It's kind of your minimum service agreement. You don't get paid shit. You have to have a degree, which I don't like that requirement, but what it tells you is that, especially, you know, this is going back to 2011, you're a degreed professional. You don't have to do this, okay? You don't have to do this. This is a voluntary servitude, and it's true service. But the other side of it was, my God, do you understand the lessons learned from service like that that are relevant to things like oh, I don't know, survival, preparedness, permaculture, growing your own food, being self-sufficient, being self-reliant. I mean, people in these places, and I think people that maybe have never been to them, or they have misguidedly believed they've been to them, but they've never been to them. Because, you know, Panama City, Panama has some really slum hole, shithole places. But nothing could have prepared me for what I would find when I went to Honduras, or even when I went out into rural areas of Panama to see how people lived. And they were not miserable. They just really lived without a lot of things we take for granted. In fact, many of those places, in general, those people were really happy. Now, a lot of them also really dreamed of coming and living where you and I are. And it's kind of a, you know, mixed blessing type situation where you look at the way they're living and go, I don't know if you really want that. And the other side of you is like, yeah, but I'm not going to go do what you're doing, right? So I think there's a ton to be learned and taken away from here. So let's go ahead and flashback. October the 13th, 2011, Tom Hale on serving in the Peace Corps. With that, let's go ahead and get into the main topic of today's show, which again is about the Peace Corps and what service in the Peace Corps is like. And again, I have on the line Mr. Tom Hale, who's been a member of the Peace Corps, spent 2 years doing that. Prior to that, he lived in Texas. Now he's back in Texas again. He's had a tremendous amount of knowledge and a tremendous amount of life-changing experience as being a member of the Peace Corps. Hey, Tom, thanks for joining us today to share your experiences with us on the Survival Podcast.
Thank you very much, Jack.
Hey, Tom, could you just give people kind of the synopsis? Who is Tom Hale? Where are you from? You know, that type of thing. What are you doing now? I mean, you're out of the Peace Corps now, so kind of what was your background before and now after?
Oh, well, I grew up in Katy, Texas, and I had never really left Texas until I became drinking age. So I was in college and was able to travel a little bit. And once graduating from Lamar University in 2000, I started working as a computer programmer. I had various jobs moving around every couple of years and stuff. And I just got a little disenchanted with the day-to-day grind of it. I was, you know, had the house and the nice area and the friends and all that, but just something was missing. And so once I got married, my wife wanted to do Peace Corps, and I wanted to do Peace Corps based on talking to other people that did Peace Corps. And I was just like, wow, let's check it out. Let's do it. It was at a great time in our life that we were able to just kind of cast off a lot of material and move on. We volunteered at various places before our Peace Corps service started. It took about a year to get the paperwork done and the medical, and we ended up in Washington, D.C. With our group in a room in a hotel and meeting people that we had no idea they would become lifelong friends.
Very cool. You know, and I just had somebody come up to our booth in Salt Lake City and ask me why I include Peace Corps in the service discount for the MSB. You know, with law enforcement and military. And my response was because when I was in Honduras, there were some folks that were in the Peace Corps that were about 5 miles from where we were. And as bad as we had it, they had it worse. and there were some people in the area that were somewhat dangerous. There were a lot of people that were just needing help and looking for help. And there were good people that were living there, but there was some danger in the area. We had guns and a whole fortification. We'd shoot back, and we had an infantry contingent. And these guys were just really on their own. And my feeling was not only were they in the same muck that we were, so to speak, helping the same people that we were, and in many ways doing with less than we had, I have no doubt that when they left, the people in the area had a better view of the United States after they left. So, folks, if you want to know why I do that, that's exactly why. And I thought I'd share that with you guys that Tom's here. But what I wanted to ask you, Tom, is in your experience, is the Peace Corps mission effective and worthwhile?
Definitely. With the three directives of the Peace Corps, first being send over trained men and women to interested countries. Number two is to share what American is. You know, how do they view life? What's their day-to-day in America? And then the third directive, which I appreciate the opportunity right now, is to share about the people that I served with, the Malagasy. And definitely in the muck is a good way of putting it. There was various experiences in Madagascar, you know, when you're walking around with a bunch of people carrying knives and shovels and all sorts of dangerous implements of death. If you watch them hunt, it's very, very interesting and very rewarding. There was definitely,
you kind of stick out in that group, don't you? It's obvious that you're the one that's, as we say in Texas, you're not from around here now, are you, son?
Very, very true. Since I had very limited experience growing up, I used to watch TV and they would be speaking in a foreign tongue, and I was like, well, that's gibberish. They're just not speaking English. I had no idea of foreign languages. And then once I got to college and met people that weren't American, then I started to really realize the differences in culture and perspective and points of view.
Do you think that's one of the reasons the Peace Corps requires somebody to have a college degree? I've always kind of found that as an unnecessary roadblock. I looked at it as a service that I think that anybody can be educated to do, and I've always kind of had an issue with that.
Well, I think there has to be a certain foundation or broadness of education for the Peace Corps to accept someone. There's a lot of different sectors that the Peace Corps is in, you know, environment, health, education, even small business. And countries, they can get particular skill sets. Like one country might only want MBAs. One country might only want PhDs, you know. So there is a very good aspect of having a well-rounded, educated person to be dropped in these situations. Now, one thing they can't really test is the emotional stability kind of thing. And a lot of people have a lot of volunteers have issues that they have to work through being isolated. Not speaking English for months at a time. My wife and I were lucky in that particular instance because we had each other. But it gets tough. The isolation is tough. So
you're sitting in Austin and you're making probably decent money as a computer guy. And you say to yourself one day, I need to do something with my life more than this and see more than this. You hadn't really been that well traveled. And you decide on the Peace Corps, and you're sitting there as a computer guy in Austin, and you know, Texas, Silicon Valley, basically. And what made you think you had something to offer these other folks around the world?
Well, from my personality, it's like I like to kind of jump into the unknown. You know, it's like sink or swim. I wanted to go somewhere and see how they lived. Kind of get outside of America, kind of detox from American materialism. And I thought that I could offer insight, maybe even a little bit of a larger perspective, if gaining a viewpoint outside of their own culture, kind of, you know, being outside of the box looking in. And I was really looking forward to the training that Peace Corps offered. I mean, there's just a whole list for environmental volunteers to get to go through, from, you know, from tree grafting. You know, we covered bees, permaculture was introduced, and we were able to harvest corn and rice and dry land farming, also in the wetland farming, even the basic skills of haggling, going to the market and haggling, and gardening and compost, of course, and cleaning fowl, goose, chicken, ducks, and even animal husbandry. And being an educated, fairly educated individual, picking up those skills, it was very, very enticing. And then also, even more so, is being put in a situation where I could share that to those that are interested. It was very enticing, and I was very glad that I did it.
So, what did you think maybe the biggest benefit you got? What did you gain from 2 years in I think Madagascar is where you were for your entire experience?
Yes, in Madagascar. We traveled around Madagascar, so we got a good feeling of the different regions and dialects Some were very difficult to understand. But I'd say that the biggest benefit that I got was kind of a connectedness, humanity, how humanity is connected. You know, we're all going through the human experience, no matter what our origin of birth is. And being able to see one culture different from another culture gives a lot of insight into one's culture, so into the American culture. And culture being kind of like the invisible hand, not of economics, but of course of Americans' culture. It's like more like a fist of culture, which will strike people down and keep them in line, kind of social justice kind of thing. And getting insight into that makes it a little bit easier to cope in American society. It's like understanding that a lot of the issues that we have are solutions to problems from the past. And we just keep on propagating a solution turns into a problem as we need to find another solution for the past problem. And not getting tied up in that downward spiral, but just realizing that can do with less. Being in Madagascar, there was no running water, no electricity, and we had to sometimes leave the village to go get vegetables. And when the boats wouldn't come, vegetables weren't there. Hmm. So making do with what the locals are doing. I mean, they're surviving. They're doing it.
Sure.
You know, we're eating
it. But wait a minute. I mean, Tom, you're in the Peace Corps. Aren't you supposed to be one of these peacenik hippies all for all these social justice, Oakland and Chicago style? I mean, are you actually telling us that going over there and serving in that capacity taught you that maybe government fixing it with a fist isn't the way to go?
Oh, definitely not the way to go. Definitely.
There's a softball for you. Knock it out of the park.
Yeah, that's right. Well, there's many instances that we would travel around and we would see foreign aid. You know, we went through one village and saw a bunch of people sitting outside of a big silo-looking thing. And it was like, what are they doing? And seeing sacks of USAID, USA rice. And they're just sitting around waiting for the food to show up. And so seeing people sitting outside of this silo thing waiting for rice to show up. And it wasn't even a lean time.
But if it's free, you might as well get in line, right?
That's right. That's right. It's totally free. Get in line. But then other instances where we saw the government aid just kind of fall flat was another village I was on. I went on two medical missions as an interpreter with by the Holy Spirit. And on one of those, we were visiting small villages around, and I saw canisters, empty oil canisters fortified with vitamin A. Where is it now? It's like a one drop scoop.
Sure.
And
sure.
Then kind of up, going up the highway on the east side of Madagascar, you see these old, broken down, rusted tractors, relics of exporting the Green Revolution. You know, and the area we were in was very wet. There's no roads to each of these, I guess you would say they're rice fields, small rice fields, kind of on the hillside, and things of that nature. And it was just, where's government then?
Yeah, and I mean, from what I hear you saying, while you and your buddies are out in Madagascar teaching the people how to grow rice sustainably, foreign aid is dumping bags of dried rice on their doorstep.
Right. It's just like...
Nothing changes, right? Give a man a fish and feed him for a day, teach him to fish and feed him for his lifetime.
Right, exactly. And that's one pretty cool aspect of Peace Corps is we were taught to teach teachers to teach. And so these techniques you'd find, you'd go into villages and you were basically looking for, kind of as Jared Diamond describes in Collapse, you're looking for the big man. So the big man would be the influential member of that community, not one that's elected, because usually they don't want to have anything to do with politics. And you find those influential members of society that people just naturally listen to. and you teach them the technique, you show them the benefit to it, and then they'll propagate it forward. They do your job for you.
Yeah, I mean, I've listened to Lawton and Mollison from the permaculture world talk a lot about going in and doing things like that. And I kind of wanted to tell you a little story here and see if maybe you have anything that would relate or be similar to it. They talked about Jeff Lawton talked about going to this one place somewhere in South America and taking these people from a slash and burn agriculture system to a chop and drop. And basically going from annuals to perennial trees and bushes. I mean, they're in the tropics. I mean, it doesn't make sense to not utilize and harness that type of stuff there. So they set them up and they explained everything and they got the big man on board, the guy that's like, you know, the leader within, so to speak. And they thought they had done everything right and they came back a year later and everything was messed up. And the reason it was messed up is they weren't clear about the whole when to cut. So if you're going to cut for chop and drop, you do it in going into the rainy season so that the stuff doesn't dry up, and so it's there on the ground, and so the moisture accelerates the breakdown of the material, and that's what you do. And that way you lose your shade at the time of the year when you can afford to lose it. The trees coppice, and you're back to canopy by the time you get into the dry season, and you've got that layer of mulch down. Well, since they were slashing and burning, they cut their stuff in the dry season, because that's when you would want to cut it to burn it. So they changed what they were doing, but the people cut the stuff at the worst time of the year, so they were kind of back where they started. And I think that, like, that's a learning experience about this, you know, cross-cultural stuff, that one little nuance can wreck a system.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. We were teaching clay stoves and make sure that you get the right mixture of ash and the red clay and getting that just right. And that was just, those are instructions that have to be followed correctly. We also did, like, it's, I guess in Mambazá, it's a manioc grafts, and they have to be done correctly, as in you pick the top portion of the graft from the manioc that produces the big leaves that they would pound up and make a side dish out of. And you take the manioc that goes in the bottom of the big tubers, and so that when you put them together, you get the best of both worlds. And so those little details, they had to have been worked out ahead of time to bring that technique to the people, because they have a lot of different varieties of manioc, and getting the small tuber with the small leaves wouldn't work out real well. And so there was definitely a lot of exchange with the locals to get that straightened out. Yeah, it'd be a total failure if they went with the both dwarfs.
Yeah, so I mean, and I guess another thing maybe you guys are doing there, and I'm spitballing here, but I'm thinking you're probably going into these countries finding indigenous people that already know what the heck they're doing, and this was information everybody had. You're kind of restoring the knowledge, so you're probably learning as much as you're teaching.
Oh, definitely. The preferred rice playing technique was SRI, and it's a intensive. It's like square foot gardening for rice kind of thing, and that was developed up north in Madagascar, and the Malagasy hadn't really picked it up. It was picked up more in Thailand, and to bring that, to reintroduce that technique, it was kind of a little culture shock for them, because they have their way of doing it and that's the way it is. But to show them, you know, we prepared and planted a field and we got four times the yield. And, you know, it kind of perked up their ears, and they started paying attention. And my wife especially really spearheaded picking up, grabbing the heads of the different little loose organizations to have a training, to get them involved, to get them to try it and see it. And I don't think it really took off until the big man, who was our counterpart, started doing it. He really started seeing the benefit, and we've left since then. But he's still doing SRI. So with him spearheading it, I'm sure it'll be picked up.
It makes me think of people like working in the cities, you know, with gang groups and stuff like that. The only way they ever get any traction is to get buy-in from some of the people in the community that already have the respect, and to basically funnel everything through them versus go in and lecture as an outsider.
Oh, totally. We would have to be kind of initially we would have to go around with our counterpart or his brother in order to even be heard, kind of thing. Because it's just you got to have the respect of the big man.
So let's talk about some of the projects you did. We've kind of talked about growing rice. Remember the whole list of stuff you guys did here. And you mentioned this one. You were teaching these folks how to make clay stoves?
Yes. It was really, really simple, just a clay ring, you know. Anything better than a three-rock configuration would be better. So we did a ring, and that would give them 50% more efficiency with their fire. And we thought about migrating to a two-pot method with a chimney, but it was a little sophisticated for the rural area. We had a number of people pick this up, and it's especially effective for the soup kitchens, or the soupies. They're like a little restaurant that they would have a huge pot, and it would be going all day because you never know when somebody will show up and want some soup. And so they would conserve a lot of firewood by using one of these massive, essentially, it's a clay ring.
Sure. Yeah, you sit and you wonder how these people that live there with these resources around them don't see them as resources. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to make a ring out of clay. But I guess that a lot of this stuff gets lost, and if you grow up seeing somebody do something a certain way, you just keep doing it. The next one on your list here is taro and cassava graphing. From what I know, taro is a root crop. It's like the, I think it described as the potato of the tropics. So you're grafting that, or am I thinking of a different plant?
No, it's actually the manioc is what I meant to
say. Oh, okay.
Say. It's the manioc, which I covered. But taro being a root crop starchy, it's one of those go-tos during lean times. They would have the manioc, the taro, and the breadfruit. If you're familiar with the breadfruit,
sure.
It goes on a tree. It's easily propagated. And it's, if you eat that, it's like a brick in your gut.
Okay.
It's like, how's this going to feel coming out? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they would create some kind of like a jello coconut paste almost. And a couple of tablespoons of that, you're done. It's like you don't feel hungry at all. But they love the rice. And so they're the largest consumer of rice per capita in the world.
Really?
They can't grow enough rice. And they prefer their local rice, but when we were there, they would get rice from Pakistan. And so the government would have to make sure they have enough contracts to feed their people. And when they knew there was going to be some, like, really, really lean times, they cut exports of Malagasy rice.
Sure.
To keep it in country.
What's the rough population of Madagascar? It's not a place we usually think of.
Right, I think it's like a little over 18 million.
Okay.
With over 87% rural.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're all spread out in the countryside. I mean, you can't go out and take a piss without eyeballs on you. They are all over the place, and they are surviving. And it's really, really...
So you're amazing. Saying there's a high-density population even in the rural environments, where in like country like the U.S., we have high-density in the urban environments and low-density in a rural environment.
Right, correct.
I wouldn't have expected that. I always thought of Madagascar as like this open wilderness type place. So let's talk about some of the other stuff you guys did. You guys had quite a few permaculture type things you were doing there as well.
Well, we had some training in permaculture. There was the way that they trained. They would bring one-year volunteers to train the newbies. And there was a couple that trained us in permaculture, and the Intro to Permaculture book was available. That's when I first started hearing about it. And they talked about locality of resources on your lot, and primarily about compost. You know, you don't want to carry the compost all over the place. You want to make compost where you need it, but it needs to be convenient to where you're going to have your resources. Like, for instance, we chunked compost material out the window. And so it was really close. It was really tight. It was really convenient. And utilizing manures and building compost for a tree nursery. We picked up a project for a tree nursery. So I was constantly making compost to fill little plastic pots to grow trees. And one tree I was particularly proud of growing was the mangosteen tree. So I was able to get a few of those out there. They have a lot of health benefits, and the Malagasy knew about that. Plus, they're really, really tasty. One of my favorite fruits.
And they're a huge yield, too, once the tree's mature.
Yes. Definitely.
Very, very. So you guys did a tree nursery. I guess people wonder sometimes, like, when you leave, what happens to that nursery?
Well, it'd be picked up. So a local farmers association picked it up. I was working with the director who lived just a few doors down. He was kind of a Renaissance man. You know, he ran this farmers association. He was a rice farmer. He also had a little a little storefront where he sold little knickknacks and grains and oils and stuff like that. And he hauled just a boatload of red clay to his little area, and he built a bread oven, and he sold bread, and he was also very very influential in the church there, and he had his family taking care of his kids and stuff, and his wife, and he took over the pepiniere.
And that's what I wanted people to understand, that you guys are not going in and doing something. It's not a one-shot deal. You guys are setting up sustainable systems when you're doing this. It often makes me look around at my own country and realize, from what I've seen being in the third world, a different part of it than you, but very, very similar mentality of the people, I would assume, that you go in and you show these people what to do, and there's like no resistance. If it freaking works, they'll do it, and they'll run with it, and they'll start teaching other people how to do it tomorrow. Sometimes you have that that cultural thing that they're attached to, and you have to break it. But the second you break it, and like you said, it's usually like the leader within that gets it broken. The second they see it work, they're done looking for reasons not to do it, and they're trying to figure out how to go like full tilt bore with it. Where in the United States, we'll get some city official coming in saying, you know, that dirt in that old abandoned lot might not be safe to grow food in. Here, eat this pesticide-laden apple instead.
Oh, definitely true. Another thing that we were really focusing on was gardens around the house. And so they have their little, I guess, their little shack, I guess you'd say. It's made out of rhodden leaves, which is interesting. It's a palm, actually. But anyway, they'd have an area around their house that they would want absolutely bare. Like, they would dig up the grass. They would make sure there's nothing right around their house. Whereas us, we have yards, right? We want something green around us. But they have green all around them. They want something not green around them. But we were really trying to focus on, hey, grow a garden, keep it close. That way you don't have to worry about thieves. You can water if it needs watering. You can weed it if it needs weeding. And we had a friend pick that up. And she was actually doing really well with it. So it was like, all right, you know, they know it works, and she's doing it.
Because when they do that, they clear that even the area just around the house, they're creating erosion issues.
Yeah, that's true. We would travel to this other village. We were actually doing a kind of site assessment. Another thing about the way the Peace Corps works is someone in a village would do a petition. They would fill out an application, would go to Peace Corps. Peace Corps would see if there's volunteers around that area that could go and visit, do a site assessment, filling out some paperwork, send that back in, and then Peace Corps themselves would come out, talk to the local officials, talk to the sponsor, see the house, see if it's adequate, and then make a decision on if a volunteer could be placed there. So there's a couple of back and forths there, and so we were doing the site assessment, and at one particular time, because we went back a couple of times, it was rainy. And the place that we were staying is at Bertin's. We were staying at his place, and his cabinet, his outhouse, was down kind of below his house. And he lived in the wet clay, red clay area, and it was slippery as all get out. So, you know, if you got an urge at midnight, you're taking your life in your own hands. And, yeah. You know, they tried a little cut, little steps and stuff like that, but, of course, it just erodes and erodes and erodes and erodes. And so it was... Yeah, it was calamity.
Well, Another thing I see that you guys worked with, and I know there's a lot of deforestation problems in Madagascar. I think that they've reversed a lot of it, but it's still an issue, and it's something that can go back to you. And all these people are using wood to cook with all the time. You guys did some work with them on solar cooking as well?
Yeah, well, there were some projects definitely in Peace Corps, especially up north. They did a lot of solar projects. But the one thing about solar and, you know, in the Peace Corps literature and stuff, they showed a picture of a bunch of wood sitting in a solar cooker while the person's cooking on a three rock system. And, it was kind of a big kind of technological leap for the solar for where we were. But, one thing that we got a pretty good response of during training with our host mother was it's a hot basket. This thing it's great. So you've got a basket, it's full of like rice hulls, like pillows of rice hulls. And so you can put your hot pot, so you start some rice. So you might cook it for 5 minutes and you stick it in this insulated basket where it's insulated on all sides, top and bottom. And then you just wait. And then after an hour and a half or so, it would be cooked.
So then you use a tenth of the wood necessary because you're bringing it to temperature and you're not using fuel to hold the temperature, you're using insulation.
Right.
It sounds like you learn all kinds of survival skills being in a third world nation where people don't have all the systems of support. Call me nuts, but that's what it sounds like you're saying.
Yeah, true. Just to kind of go down the list where we were at, it seemed fairly fortunate. We had a concrete slab. And then the rest of the building, the rest of the house was kind of traditional, which is made from the traveler's palm. So this palm is just amazing. So from the broad leaves, they can split them and they put them on like roofing tiles. And then the walls are made from like the spine of those palm leaves, which are cut and dried, and they're stood on end kind of horizontal, and they form the walls. And then traditionally, the floors are made from the trunk of that tree, where it's split, dried, and then split to lay flat. And so from this one traveler's palm, they can get 90% of their house.
Unbelievable.
It's really amazing. And so that's what we had. And just from day one, I was able to get a 55-gallon plastic barrel. The volunteers before us had one, which they used for just a bucket shower. And then I talked to my partner and I said, hey, I need bamboo. You know, the gargantuan big bamboo they cut in half and they chisel out the little portions in the middle and stuck it up so that it would catch the rainwater. And it just filtered right into that 55-gallon barrel.
So basically you made rain gutter out of bamboo.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I had that 55-gallon barrel up about 2 or 3 feet, and I had an extra spout from our Berkey water filter, and I just plumbed it, and so I had running water.
Unbelievable. And, I mean, I'm having a dumb moment with the bamboo rain gutter. It kind of, like, just screams out, this is what I was, you know, one of the things I was made to do. And I think that when we live in a world of Home Depots, we lose that. I know I gave away to a guy when we were breaking down the camp in Honduras. We had, different stuff that we just didn't want to take back. And one of the things, we had like a stick. It was like a 10-foot stick, a half-inch PVC pipe. And you don't do a lot with one. I mean, because you're not going to go down the street and get another one or a coupler. But I gave this dude that stick of pipe, and he was really happy about it. I mean, getting another rain barrel, I guess it puts it in perspective that these things that we take for granted, I mean, half-inch PVC is dirt cheap. But if you don't have it, you got to make do with what you do have.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Which one traditional method of carrying water that the Malagasy had, there was this like giant bird that was on the island. So the Malagasy have only been at Madagascar for 1,500 years. So with evolution, there was a period of time that these animals evolved without humans. So they didn't evolve any defensive mechanisms. So when humans show up, you know, these big birds are like, hey, what are you? And then dead, you know. And also there's there's like so many types of species of large lemur dead, you know. So the Malagasy, they originally they had these eggs, these huge eggs, kind of like bigger than an ostrich egg, that they would carry water in. And then they migrated to bamboo. So they would use bamboo as a container. You know, it's all about the container, right?
Sure.
And then now they have plastic containers and metal containers and all that stuff. But they had everything they needed right around. And even today, you know, it's like if I need something to tie something down, I look down for some kind of vine or something that I could use to tie something up with.
Sure.
You know, if you need something, start looking around. And that's exactly the way they did things. So if they needed to carry something, they'd look around and be, oh, here's some good cordage from, you know, bark of a tree kind of thing. And they would use it, and when they didn't need it, they would throw it down, they'd throw it back. So it was on the ground. You know, maybe something
biodegradable, it becomes part of the soil at that point. So when I was in Central America, you mentioned birds, like one of the real staples to existence for people in these remote areas were poultry. Down there it was chickens and ducks, and most of the ducks down there were the Muscovy ducks because they're actually native to the area. Did you see a lot of use of poultry for sustainability in Madagascar?
Oh, definitely. Definitely, especially the chickens. They were like prehistoric looking. You know, they were like scrawny and scrappy, and you couldn't kill them with an axe. Well, yeah, I guess you could, but they would run around and in droves, and they would just wreak havoc. You had to have some kind of fencing up to keep some vegetation alive. And, you know, here comes a mama hen with her 10 chicks, right? Because since they're free range, they would lay eggs, and the owners would hardly ever find them. And so the chickens would run amok, and they were meant for survival. And so during lean times, they could find their chickens. And the way they would kind of keep them close is they would call them and give them rice every once in a while just to train them so that they wouldn't lose them forever. But they know their chickens. There was a particular instance where this one woman was walking through the bazaar, and she started yelling and screaming at this one guy who had a chicken, you know, dead chicken up. And the reason was because she recognized her chicken. He stole it.
So it's like rustling back in the old West, you know. They put your brand on. These people don't need a brand. They actually know their particular strain or individual chickens.
Right. And they had chickens, ducks, geese, turkeys. The turkeys were pretty funny. The name of a turkey was, let's see if I can say it, because that was the name of the sound of the turkey. It was foreign, right? Because they didn't know the name of it, so they just made it up. And so they had definitely a lot of fowl.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I don't want everybody to think that it's all roses over there, though, because this is all cool stuff. You saw some stuff go on over there we'll kind of finish up on, because I think it teaches us some things about, you know, collapse society and some of the things we may be headed for if we don't straighten up. You mentioned to me that you saw kind of cities just start taxing people and did it a little bit differently than we're accustomed to.
Oh, yes. It's I think our partner was starting to pay taxes. And I don't know if it was I think it was a top-down initiative. And it was kind of sold as being, you know, good for the city, for these people that have money to contribute. And it's kind of, as I say, it's that first fall of liberty and freedom, you know, and really tugging on that, what do you say, it's kind of like that, you're doing so well, why don't you provide kind of mentality.
And, flash warfare.
Yeah, definitely. It's like the way I saw, so... they were voting. So there was like so many men that came together. One guy had a cap and they all started picking up rocks. And I was like, what are they doing? They're picking up rocks. And, three of them kind of left off to the side. And the other, I think it was about 20 of them were putting rocks in hats. And I was like, what are they doing? It's like, oh, they're voting on their sheriff. And so it's like, that's how they did it. You know, it's like they know each other, they respect each other, and they know who they want to kind of govern over them. And to introduce some kind of taxation, it didn't really make any sense. You know, there's a couple of thousand people in the string of villages. And so it was kind of a sad sight to see from my perspective.
And they were, you said they would basically like show up at your house and go, dude, you owe us money?
That's right. I don't know. With taxation, I think it's quite funny to me. If you think back to, let's say, you know, some guy out in the wilderness, this is back in America. So if you think about some guy out in the wilderness in America, or actually someone in Madagascar, and some guy just knocks on the door and says, "Hey, you owe me money. And if you don't pay, I got a couple of guys over here that'll put you in jail." It's just like, what are you calling? What's this taxation thing? You know, when it first started, it just seems brutal to me.
It's legalized extortion. We've just made it comfortable for people.
Right.
You've also mentioned that you guys had problems over there with theft, vanilla and produce specifically.
Oh, there was one death that occurred over vanilla. And I think it was in our region, because our partner, he does a lot of vanilla, and he started putting locks on the door. He's got his metal doors, and he was really taking some precautions. And there's something less severe was this one guy was caught stealing, and I think he stole some food or something like that, and all the women were around him, and like the sheriff was there. And then the sheriff, you know, the women are all squawking at him and stuff like that. And then the sheriff just goes, "Okay." And then they told the guy to run, and all these women just started beating on him with their shoe.
That's their discipline system.
Right, and the guy had to run through the village.
And get beat on. So not only did he get punished quickly and sufficiently, it was kind of like the old thing where we used to put people in the stocks. He was known now as being a thief.
Right, yes. Because over there, you don't want to be in prison. So during the medical missions, we visited the prisons, both male and female. And the problem with the, you know, developing country, third world country, is they don't have the resources to feed the people in prison. And so it was up to friends and family to feed that person in that prison, or they would only get like very minute portions. And it was hard to see. I was really glad to be able to provide some medical service in my capacity.
Well, I mean, I think people are getting kind of a new view of Peace Corps and what it's all about. Something we share in common, you mentioned road construction. That's what I went to Honduras to do. We built a road about 10 miles long where there formerly was a path. My experience is that it is one of the most meaningful things you can do for a society, because it brings them the ability to be part of their overall economy, because it brings stuff in and takes stuff out. And it's something that's so basic to us in the United States. There is not a town in America you can't drive a car to. And there's no such thing. It just doesn't exist, even if you have to take some dirt roads. But in a lot of countries, a road is a luxury. I mean, is that, because I've never been to Madagascar. Would you say there's places in Madagascar where that is the case?
Where the road is a luxury? Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
So we were on one of the main highways, right, which basically is a wide dirt road kind of thing. And going from where we were down south, it was fairly treacherous. It was rocky. It was hilly. It was slippery. We had six river crossings that you had to wait for the tide to rise in order to get across. They had recently had new kind of big concrete ferries, but moving up north to Montserrat from where we were, we had a number of river crossings where they had bamboo rafts. And so when you're with the car in the bamboo raft and the water is coming up to your ankles, and you're like, "Wait, the raft is submerged. How are we going to make it?" And getting across to these roads that are rutted, gutted, and hard to pass. You get stuck. We got stuck on a bridge. They had to cut the bridge in order to get across. And the roads were pretty treacherous. There was, you know, I think one time we noticed that in our village that everyone was out with their shovels, and they were there to kind of cut the road, kind of make it look nice. And then there was a kind of a guideline where big, huge, really tall coconut trees were going to be a hazard in the next cyclone. So they had to be cut. And so they cut it, and then all the villagers, they came out and they prepared that tree trunk and they drug it. So it probably took 20 guys, and we drug that thing to create kind of a pedestrian pathway where the road took a big dip, and it was always wet. And so they had to do their own road construction, and even moving about in between a bunch of villages where we did some work, we would come up against people that would rope the road off, and they would be working the road, and they would just ask for a donation. So you give them a little donation for rice or whatever, and they just keep working. And they're just making sure that they're funneling the water correctly so it doesn't keep eroding the road. So
because it's that important to them that they're willing to go do it. I only ever saw one thing like that in my life, and it was one guy. In Panama City, there were always people, wherever you went, there was somebody panhandling or selling something that was really worthless, and they were just basically saying, I'm trying to do something so they give me some money. Then there was this dude. There was this road that came out of the backside of Fort Kobe and went along Veracruz Beach, and it was like a back way to the Bridge of Americas. And there was this dude. He got a shovel and a wheelbarrow, and there was potholes everywhere. And this dude would show up every day with his shovel, and he'd go off in the woods, and he'd shovel dirt and rock and gravel, and he'd fill in holes. And it was about a 10-12-mile stretch. And that dude was there every day. And when he got to the end of the road, it was already starting to erode at the other end, and he'd just start back at the beginning. And he did it every day for 2 years I was there. And people would just pull over and do some halves or whatever and throw him a couple bucks. And it always struck me as odd why, like, nobody else ever showed up unless maybe he had it, you know, like, you know, he had a pretty good set of pipes on him on the arms from doing that all the time. He might have been protecting his territory, but it was a 12-mile road. And I've never seen anything else like that. So you've seen where, like, it's a community event.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But also, hey, Jack, just imagine all the panhandlers, all the people on the side of the corner, on the corners asking, begging for money. If no one gave them money, what would they have to do to make money?
Whatever they can figure out, right?
Yeah, would they be fixing the roads? Would they be cleaning up trash? Would they be planting trees? I don't know. But giving them money doesn't give them the opportunity to innovate and adapt. And that's a shame.
I'll tell you, I've got a road that leads up to my place, and if people want to start showing up and filling in potholes on it, I'll probably stop and give you a dollar every day on the way out. I do think that is actually a business model, that people, I mean, we pay taxes for roads. I'd rather pay the guy building the road than pay the government and let them waste 90% of it and then give 10% to the guy that builds the road. Or the Chicago Crime Syndicate family that owns the company that builds the road, right? I mean, it dumbfounds me that as little as they have in the rest of the world, they actually come up with more efficient models, but that's probably why they come up with more efficient models.
Right, true. Whereas, you know, where we'll give $32 billion for a USAID to do foreign relief work or whatever. And it's just like, how much does it cost to hand out rice? What else are they doing?
You sound like Brandon when he went down to Haiti and they took like $8,000 down there and they built two wells and put in a water purification system with that. And he said that the Salvation Army got like $130 million and they never even saw a single Salvation Army sign the entire time they were there, let alone saw them do anything.
Oh, right. So, yeah, I mentioned the medical missions I went on. So I went on two, one each year. And we would go around in these small villages and see hundreds and hundreds of people. And a lot of times we're just handing out multivitamins, and, you know, doing a check to make sure everything's okay. And then other times they're doing ultrasounds on new mothers or pregnant women, you know, checking the health and status of their babies, making sure they're getting prenatal care, and then saving lives. They emergency care. What do you say? It's like emergency surgery for a few of them just to save their lives. And these people are boots on the ground. They're their own funding. They paid for it out of their own pocket, and they got some funding from various churches to go out there and actually do good. It was really, really rewarding to be a part of.
Well, Tom, fascinating stuff. I know you could probably talk for another hour if I'd let you. You're always welcome to come back on the show and talk about any of this stuff. What I'm hoping is that people have a new view of what the Peace Corps is all about.
like I said, those two guys that we knew that were in Honduras 5 miles away from us, they had it rougher than we did in a lot of ways. And they didn't have the means of defense that we did. Kind of what I'd like to finish up with, though, is when you look around our country here today, not just that there is some real cultural value in these other societies. I think they have better social relationships and all. But what I take away from it often is I look at how dependent we are, and I think if one system fails, a lot of what those people have to deal with will have to deal with. I mean, do you kind of feel the same way?
Right, that my life in Madagascar might be a future viewing of America?
That's what I'm asking, yep.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. There, they had their stable crops, stuff that they didn't want to eat, but they would eat if nothing else was available. And they tended to those, the mountain potatoes, the manioc, the high starch, the belly fillers. There wasn't a whole lot of meat in our village. Every once in a while there might be cow. Twice a year there might be pig, and it was expensive. It was very expensive. And so they relied on essentially weeds and rice, lots of rice. And they'd have their bitter greens and their salty broth, and that's what they would eat 3 times a day. And there are even more less fortunate. There is even less fortunate individuals out there that only had bananas. We heard stories when we were hiking across the Maswalas for a week that there's people out in the bush that only have bananas, and if they can, they'll cook them. And so I don't know if we'll get that bad off, but you got to have your staples. You got to have something to fall back on for food. If you got food in your belly, you can look for something else.
Yeah, I've always said if you have food today, you can find food for tomorrow, but if you don't have food today, you've got a real problem.
Right.
It's amazing what you'll do if you have to, but when you're on an empty belly, it's hard to do much of anything. Definitely, I thank you for your service, and I thank you for being on the show with us today.
I appreciate the opportunity, Jack.
All right, folks, with that, I am going to wrap up. I do hope you have a new view of the Peace Corps. I know I've talked to some of you guys that think they're just a bunch of ponytail hippie types, and what they really are is people trying to do more good around the world, and we could use a little bit more of that. And the value of the experience there, I think a lot of you guys that email me that are 18, 19, 20 years old or young college graduates to say, you know, I like the idea of the military, but I'm really not sure it's right for me. This might be something you want to look into. And I also think it makes sense for, as you're building your communities out there, whether it's through your church or your neighborhoods or whatever, seek these guys out that have done this stuff. They make pretty dadgone good, real community organizers, right? Not somebody that lines up and marches down the street with a sign asking for social justice. I was actually really pleased to hear Tom's view on that today, and I'm glad that got a chance to come out. So take all this stuff, and hopefully we'll get Tom back on the future to talk about some more specific things. In fact, if you have any of the kind of laundry list stuff that we went through today that you'd like me to get him on and go deeper into, whether it's permaculture or mud ovens or clay ovens or whatever, let me know and we'll try to do that. And with that, this has been Jack Spirico today along with Tom Hale, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Survival Podcast Friday Flashbacks. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider becoming an MSB member. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. You can also support our show by going to TSPAZ, that's T-S-P-A-Z, TSPAZ.com. Anytime you shop online, and while you'll support us no matter what you buy, you will find over 500 reviews of items I have personally tested and vouched for. And to stay in touch with us and never miss anything, follow our channel or our group on Telegram. You can find links to that and all our social media options. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and check the show notes for any episode.